Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So, we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today on the program, Ashley Thompson and I travel out west to a national park in Colorado. Later in the show, we hear another classic American story. But first, here is Dan Friedel with a story about an unusual sale in Pennsylvania.
You are in luck if you want to buy a life-sized reproduction of a former American president. On January 14th, a museum plans to sell off its entire statue collection of 43 presidents and their wives. They are being offered for sale at a public auction. The First Lady statues, it should be noted, are not life-size. The museum is in the historic town of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. It is called the Gettysburg Hall of Presidents. The head of each statue is made of wax. The body is a combination of fiberglass and wood. The business is closing after 60 years. It says, not enough people come to visit. Visitors could hear recordings of important speeches made by the presidents. Max Felt is the president of Gettysburg Tours, which operates the museum. He told the Baltimore Sun newspaper that his business had hoped for more visitors after the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, but attendance did not change much. In the summer of 1863, the Union Army defeated Confederate forces at Gettysburg. The battle proved to be a turning point in the American Civil War. The Confederates were forced to withdraw and retreat to the South. President Abraham Lincoln made a famous speech in the town 4 months later. Lincoln spoke about freedom and equality of all men. In addition to the statues, the museum will be selling other objects at the auction later this month. I'm Dan Friedel.
Our National Parks journey this week takes us to an extreme landscape in Colorado. Around us are clear lakes, aspen and fir trees, and mountain peaks that rise over 4,400 meters. Welcome to Rocky Mountain National Park. The vast Rocky Mountains range extends from the western United States up to Canada. National parks in both countries protect many of the huge peaks. Here in Colorado, Rocky Mountain National Park covers about 1,100 square kilometers. Although it is much smaller than other western parks like Yellowstone, it welcomes almost as many visitors each year. People from around the world come to experience its alpine or high mountain environment. In the spring and summer, wildflowers burst to life and many kinds of butterflies arrive. In the fall, the aspen trees turn bright yellow and orange. In the winter, deep snow blankets the park. Its peaceful alpine lakes freeze over. One of the major sights here is the Continental Divide. The area in the high mountains separates the rivers that flow into the Pacific Ocean from the rivers that flow into the Atlantic Ocean.
The Rockies' huge glaciers form the rivers. Glaciers help tell the natural history of the land. Over millions of years, glaciers carved deep canyons out of rock. Erosion from wind and water formed the mountains' sharp summits that we see today. Rock at the top of these summits is some of the oldest found on Earth. It was not until 11,000 years ago that humans began living in the area. The Utes tribe settled here for part of the year thousands of years ago. Winter was too severe to survive. When the weather warmed, they lived in the green valleys and meadows and near the lakes. In 1803, the U.S. government gained control of the land we now call Rocky Mountain National Park. It came as part of the Louisiana Purchase, which almost doubled the size of the United States. In the 1840s, American writer Rufus Sage came to the Rockies. He wandered the area from 1841 until 1843, spending time with fur trappers, Native Americans, soldiers, and hunters. His long and detailed account of mountain life was published in 1846. He called it Scenes in the Rocky Mountains. Rufus Sage wrote, "Further on were yet higher summits, surmounted by pines and cedars, raising their heads in stately grandeur far above the sweet valleys at their feet." Taken together, the scenery was not only romantic and picturesque, but bewitching in its beauty and repulsive in its deformity.
Beginning in the late 1850s, gold and silver rushes brought huge crowds to the Colorado Rockies. Miners arrived in search of the precious metals. They settled temporary cities. One of the best known is called Lulu City. It was settled in the late 1870s after miners discovered silver nearby. By 1880, more than 500 miners lived in Lulu City. It had a meat shop, a post office, and many houses and mining companies. Lulu City was short-lived. In just 5 years, miners left town, seeking other opportunities. Today, some visitors choose to hike to this ghost town, where they will find old cabins and remains of buildings. As more and more people came to the area, concern for protecting the natural environment grew. In 1909, the nature guide and naturalist Enos Mills began pushing for the creation of a national park here. He first climbed the towering Long's Peak when he was just 15 years old. Long's Peak is the area's tallest mountain at 4,346 meters. Mills made the hike 40 times by himself during his lifetime and almost 300 times as a mountain guide. Mills wrote and gave talks about the Long's Peak area to urge Congress to make it a national park. On January 26, 1915, Mills got his wish. President Woodrow Wilson signed the Rocky Mountain National Park Act to make America's 10th national park. The Denver Post newspaper called Mills the father of Rocky Mountain National Park.
Today, more than 3 million people visit Rocky Mountain National Park each year. In 2015, it was the third most visited national park in the country. Many visitors arrive by car. They drive the Trail Ridge Road, which winds through meadows and forests and up the mountains. The road was built in the 1930s during the Great Depression. President Franklin Roosevelt promised the country a New Deal. He started programs to put more people to work, such as the Civilian Conservation Corps. At the time, many of the Western national parks were served by the railway. Travelers arrived on trains. But a railroad never served Rocky Mountain National Park. The National Park Service described it as always an auto park. The high number of visitors and vehicles caused concern. In the 1970s, park officials began managing crowds. They started using buses in the park and created a campsite system in the wild backcountry. Today, conservation efforts continue. Park officials educate visitors and urge them to respect the natural environment.
Rocky Mountain National Park's scenery and wildlife attract huge numbers of visitors. The park has over 480 kilometers of hiking trails. They include challenging climbs up some of the tallest mountains and forest hikes that lead to the park's many waterfalls. They also include trails to crystal blue alpine lakes. One leads to Mills Lake, in honor of Enos Mills. The view of Long's Peak from the lakeside is one of the finest views in the whole park. One of the most extreme hikes in the park is the Continental Divide Loop. The 86-kilometer path cuts through glacial valleys and past lakes and waterfalls. It takes most hikers at least 6 days to complete. Long hikes give visitors a chance to experience Rocky Mountain wildlife. Within the park are hundreds of elk and bighorn sheep, as well as a small moose population. The park's huge number of large animals makes it one of the best places in America for wildlife watching.
Butterflies fill the park's meadows. Some of the most common kinds are the painted lady, the Arctic blue, and the western pine elfin. Butterflies help researchers in the park study the effects of climate change. Scientists and volunteers collected information on butterfly populations from 1995 until 2011. They identified more than 140 butterfly species. Park visitors also come to fish, bike, and go horseback riding. The animals are permitted on most of the park's hiking trails. You can ride in the park on horseback. You can explore on foot. You can sleep under the stars. You can sit by a clear, quiet lake. However you visit Rocky Mountain National Park, you will likely find, in the words of Enos Mills, the paths of peace and a repose that is sweeter than sleep. It's time for an American story. Today, we hear part two of A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs.
The creature with the spear was huge. There were many other similar creatures. They had ridden behind me on the backs of large animals. Each of them carried a collection of strange-looking weapons. The one with the large spear got down from the back of his animal and began walking toward me. He was almost 5 meters tall and a dark green color. Huge teeth stuck out of his face, and his expression showed much hate and violence. I immediately knew I was facing a terrible warrior. He began moving quickly toward me with the spear. I was completely unarmed. I could not fight. My only chance was to escape. I used all my strength to jump away from him. I was able to jump almost 30 meters. The green Martian stopped and watched my effort. I would learn later that the look on his face showed complete surprise. The creatures gathered and talked among themselves. While they talked, I thought about running away. However, I noticed several of them carried devices that looked very much like rifles. I could not run. Soon, all but one of the creatures moved away. The one who had threatened me stayed. He slowly took off a metal band from his arm and held it out to me. He spoke in a strange language.
Nictu maktuta sakota.
Slowly he laid down his weapons. I thought this would have been a sign of peace anywhere on Earth. Why not Mars, too? I walked toward him and, in a normal voice, announced my name and said I had come in peace. I knew he did not understand, but like me, he took it to mean that I meant no harm. Slowly, we came together. He gave me the large metal band that had been around his arm. He turned and made signs with his hands that I should follow him. Soon, we arrived at the large animal he had been riding. He again made a sign with his hands that I should ride on the same animal behind him. The group turned and began riding across the land. We moved quickly toward mountains in the distance. The large animals we rode moved quickly across the land. I could tell from the surrounding mountains that we were on the bottom of a long, dead sea. In time, we came to a huge city. At first, I thought the city was empty. The buildings were all empty and in poor repair. But soon, I saw hundreds of the green warriors. I also saw green women and children. I soon learned about many cities like this. The cities were built hundreds of years ago by a people that no longer existed. The green Martians used the cities. They moved from one empty city to another, never stopping for more than a day or two. We got down from our animals and walked into a large building. We entered a room that was filled with fierce green warriors. It was not difficult to tell that these were the leaders of the green Martians. One of them took hold of my arm. He shook me and lifted me off the ground. He laughed when he did so. I was to learn that green Martians only laugh at the pain or suffering of others. This huge warrior threw me to the ground and then took hold of my arm again to pick me up. I did the only thing I could do. I hit him with my closed fist as hard as I could. The green warrior fell to the floor and did not move. The others in the room grew silent. I had knocked down one of their warriors with only my hand. I moved away from him and prepared to defend myself as best I could, but they did not move. The green Martian that had captured me walked toward me. He said in a clear voice,
"Tars Tarkas! Tars Tarkas!"
As he spoke, he pointed to his own chest. He was telling me his name. I pointed to my chest and said, "My name, John Carter." He turned and said the word, "Sola." Immediately, a green Martian woman came close. He spoke to her. She led me to another building and into a large room. The room was filled with equipment carried by the green Martians. She prepared something for me to eat. I was very hungry. I pointed to her and said the word, "Sola." She pointed at me and said my name. It was a beginning. Sola was my guard. She also became my teacher. In time, she would become a close and valued friend. As I ate my meal, my lessons in the language of the green Martians continued. 2 days later, Tars Tarkas came to my room. He carried the weapons and the metal armbands the green warriors wear. He put them on the ground near my feet. Sola told him I now understood some of their language. He turned to me and spoke slowly.
"The warrior you hit is dead. His weapons and the metal of his rank are yours, John Carter. He was a leader of one small group among our people. Because you have killed him, you now are a leader. You are still a captive and not free to leave. However, you will be treated with the respect you have earned. You are now a warrior among our people.
Tars Tarkas turned and spoke softly. From beyond the door, a strange creature entered the room. It was bigger than a large dog and very ugly. It had rows of long teeth and 10 very short legs. Tars Tarkas spoke to the creature and pointed at me. He left. The creature looked at me, watching closely. Then Sola spoke about the creature.
His name is Wula. The men of our tribe use them in hunting and war. He has been told to guard and protect you. He has also been told to prevent your escape. There is no faster creature in our world, and in a fight, they can kill very quickly. Do not try to escape, John Carter. Wula will tear you to small pieces.
I continued to watch the creature named Wula. I had already seen how the green Martians treated other animals. They were very cruel. I thought, perhaps this beast can be taught to be my friend, much like a dog on Earth. I walked close to the creature and began speaking in much the same way I would speak to a dog or other animal on Earth. I sat down next to him while I talked softly. At first, he seemed confused. I believe the creature Wula had never heard a kind word. In the next several days, I gained the trust and friendship of Wula. In a few short days, Wula was my friend and fierce protector. He would remain my loyal friend as long as I was on Mars. Several days later, Sola came to me with a look of great concern.
John Carter, come with me. A great battle is about to take place. An enemy is coming near this city. We must prepare to fight, and we must be ready to flee.
Sola, what enemy is this?
A race of red men who travel our world in flying machines. A great number of their machines have come over the far mountain. Take your weapons with you, and hurry.
I collected my sword and a spear. I hurried out of the building and joined a group of warriors moving toward the end of the city. Far in the distance, I could see the airships. They were firing large guns at the green warriors. I heard huge explosions. The green warriors were firing back with their deadly rifles. The air was filled with the sound of violent battle. Suddenly, a huge airship exploded. It came down crashing near me. Red Martians were falling from the side of the huge ship, and then it exploded again.
That was Shep O'Neill, narrating A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.